Hello, and welcome back to New Books in National Security, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Beth Windisch, your host, and today we will be talking with P.W. Singer about the new book, Like Wars. P.W. co-authored this book with Emerson Brooking. P.W., welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I am a researcher in political science. I have written books on topics that range from the rise of private militaries to the rise of warlord groups and child soldiers to a book called Wired for War about the first use of robotics and unmanned systems in conflict. Then another book looking at cybersecurity and cyber war. And most recently, a book that was a hybrid of a novel and nonfiction called Ghost Fleet that looked at the future of war. I work at an organization called New America. We're basically a think tank based in Washington, D.C. And I've always been drawn to these topics of what's changing out there in national security and how do we need to understand it and what are the implications of it.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to work with your co-author and how the idea for this book came together?
Sure. So the co-author on the project, the book is called Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. And the co-author is Emerson Brooking. And he was actually originally my intern back in the day. And through various conversations, we were watching some of the early rise of this phenomena that we call Like War, how groups around the world were starting to use social media almost as a weapon. They were weaving it into their operations. And so we were seeing examples in places like not just the rise of ISIS overall, but how it was using social media to help win the Battle of Mosul, to we saw it popping up in Ukraine and the like. And essentially, we realized there's something going on here. But then there was a second part of it that our world, not just overall, but in particular the national security community, wasn't well dealing with it. One of the things we talk about in the book was that when ISIS arose, there was one study that found the word slick was used more than 5 million times to describe what ISIS was doing. We were surprised. How does this group with a, you know, 7th century version of the world, how is it doing all this new stuff, all this slick stuff online? And the two of us are looking at it going, they're basically doing what any millennial or any new movie or any new video game would do. You know, for example, they're launching an invasion, but they're simultaneously putting a hashtag out there. The hashtag was All Eyes on ISIS. So there was not just this new phenomena, but that we weren't well understanding it, weren't well appreciating it. And then we begin to see it grow and grow, and not just become used in conflicts around the world, but increasingly filtering over into politics itself. So, for example, many of the same phenomena, many of the actually same actors that we were seeing Russia use to go after, for example, Ukraine, we start seeing them pop up going after elections in Eastern Europe, then Brexit, then the United States election. And so that's where this book comes out of, is trying to understand what's playing out on social media. Where did it come from? What are its new rules? What are its new effects?
You make an early reference to Clausewitz and On War. In Like War, what thread are you following about some of those arguments about war and politics?
Sure. So, you know, it's interesting for the book, the way we went around researching it blended all sorts of different methodologies. So we brought together, you know, classic, what we would describe as references, you know, studied fields that ranged from the history of war to the history of communications to sociology to new realms in internet psychology. You know, it's for a topic where there's a lot of problems of what you might think of as fake news. We wanted to really go after that. The book actually has, don't hold me to this number, I believe it's well over 1,100 references in it to various kind of the latest in academic studies, but also big data studies. But second, and then we also did tracking, you know, as I mentioned, of dozens of conflicts and quasi-conflicts around the world, elections, how is social media being used in that? But then, more pertinent to your question, we also interviewed all sorts of people that were key in this. And they ranged from recruiters for extremist groups to tech company executives to reality stars to even General Michael Flynn, who has since become famous or infamous. But there was, you know, one person whose insights we kept coming back to who we couldn't interview. And that was the guy, Clausewitz, who, you know, well over two centuries ago, wrote about how war and politics were together along this continuum. And many of his insights hold all the more true in a world where everything and everyone is connected. And, you know, you can see this, there are a lot of the concepts that, you know, Clausewitz talks about, you know, that are now famous, the fog of war, friction, but particularly he had this core lesson that war is politics by other means. And we see this playing out in the conflicts, the wars on the networks that then affect the wars and conflicts and politics in the real world. And you see it in everything from the lessons that he talked about how there's always a back and forth, there's two sides that creates the inherent friction, but also the learning. So one of the things that the book explores is how you had these early first movers who were able to, in essence, they either naturally came to the lessons of what worked in this conflict, or they designed themselves around it. And that ranges from Donald Trump and his political campaign to, as mentioned, ISIS to, you know, one of the other episodes looks at gangs in Chicago to another, you know, fun one looks at Taylor Swift. But, you know, you have these early movers, but everyone's learning from each other. And so now we're beginning to see more and more of kind of the contestation back and forth of people using these core lessons. So, you know, you can get a lot of the insights from a Clausewitz, but then there's other aspects of it that, you know, he would never be able to wrap his head around. And I should actually do a quick aside. You know, we talk about this in the book. One of the important things to remember about Clausewitz is it's not just him. It's also his wife. Carl, in many ways kind of parallel to us in the 1800s, goes out and does a version of interviewing all the great thinkers of the day about war. He writes letters to them across Europe. He brings it together, but his writing is really opaque and it's in lots of different essays. And then he dies. And then it's his wife, Marie, who actually brings it all together in the book on war. So Marie often doesn't get the credit for her role. So in many ways, we should, you know, when we say Clausewitz, we should say the Clausewitzes. But one thing, to go back to the story, one thing that they never would have been able to wrap their head around is while they talk about the lessons of how terrain is so important to conflict, the terrain in this space is something that would have been unimaginable in the 19th century, most of the 20th century, and frankly, it's really hard for a lot of people in the 21st century to wrap their heads around how social networks work and the rules that drive them, the algorithms, the attention economy, and the like, and the fact that they're owned and operated by for-profit businesses created by a handful of tech geeks. And so the rules of this battlefield, the laws of war, so to speak, are decided by essentially a handful of people sitting in Silicon Valley. So you, when you're looking at like war, it's the terminology is a bit of an homage to them. It's also what the competing tribes of, you know, everything from Kanye West and Taylor Swift fans, they talk about engaging in like wars, to ISIS fans and U.S. military coalition fans also talk about the same. But what I'm getting at is there are some parts of it that, you know, have the essential rules of war that have held true throughout all of humanity. And then we have other new parts of it that were once inconceivable, but we all have to figure out, because guess what? We're all part of this conflict too if we're all in line.
And the book spends some time talking about the history of the internet and how it works, as well as the emergence of these different social media platforms. And you make the point that the modern information environment is becoming stable. What does that mean, and why is that stability important, and how is that relative to the history that you cover in the book?
Yeah, and this may be a point that I don't think enough of us either appreciate, and some people might, you know, frankly, be willing to argue with it, and we can go back and forth on it. But essentially, when you look at the history of the internet, you saw this massive growth, global growth, but also organizational growth, corporate growth. And then you saw this rapid churn and turnover. And, you know, look, think about the networks that you might have once been on. You know, we look at the history of social media, and you had, you know, everything from Six Degrees to Friendster to MySpace, and they're popping up. And then, frankly, they're disappearing after a couple of years. Our argument is we've actually hit the next stage of it. And like them or not, the Facebooks of the world, the Googles, they're now here to stay for a long period of time. You're not going to see that kind of rapid turnover over the next couple of years. And there's a variety of reasons for why that's happened on the corporate side. You have these sort of titans of industry, and in many ways you can think about the parallels in other communication platforms back in the say the 1800s and the early 1900s. And there's a big debate that people are having about what is the meaning of these kind of quasi monopolies, oligopolies, or the like. So you have that on the corporate side, the networks themselves. And even when we see new things pop up, the Instagrams and like, they're quickly brought into that network. So, you know, it's all part of, that would be an example of something that's part of Facebook. And so both the platforms, the organizations are come somewhat here to stay. It also means many of the most important players, voices online, who are also, frankly, what the studies call super spreaders. They're the people with the most followers who are able to steer the most online conversation. They're here to stay, again, for better or for worse. So, you know, whatever large number person online, and, you know, the prime example of this would be real Donald Trump, you're not going to see them, their follower count go down over the next couple of years. You're also, it's going to be very difficult for new voices to rise to have that same kind of follower count. There's a little bit of a first mover advantage. So these super spreaders are only going to continue to have their kind of influence. And the notion of a super spreader actually comes from outside the internet. It comes from when we look at studies of virality in the biosciences. When you look at how, for example, disease spreads, things like the flu, all the studies find that there's a small number of people that are the really key drivers of it. So, you know, for example, there was a look at an outbreak of more dangerous forms of the flu in Asia a couple years ago. And in one study in South Korea, they found, you know, among the thousands of people, there was like one guy who spread well over 40% of it. He was just the super spreader kind of connecting to everyone. So what we're getting at is the platforms, the people, but also to go back to what I was talking about with Clausewitz, the lessons of how to do it, the sort of rules of the game, the best practices, so to speak, they're also proliferating. And so what we're getting to is that the internet, you know, you almost might think of it as like a parallel. I'm the father of kids. They're reaching that point of whether we're talking about the companies themselves or the dynamics of it, it's kind of reaching adolescence. It's grown and grown, but now it's kind of coming to grips with its own power and its own kind of responsibility. And you can see this, for example, within the creators of these companies and how, again, for better and definitely for worse, they've played a role in shaping our war in politics and what they allow or not as they kind of themselves even individually mature, but also their kingdoms that they run that are simultaneously companies, that are simultaneously battle spaces, they begin to mature and lock in what they allow or not online. So it's a really, you know, a different way of putting it is the dynamics that are playing out right now, we're going to be stuck with them for the time being. And that means, again, we need to better understand them, react to them, and that better understand, react to them extends across everything from governments to the business to you and I individually to those of us who want to study these things.
And I'll just reiterate, too, I think that knowing the history of kind of where some of these platforms came from, it's really interesting. And it's also helpful that it's all in one place here. So I think this may be a useful reference for people understanding kind of where did YouTube come from and how did Twitter get where it is?
I think there's three things to spin out from that. The first is, isn't it crazy how we use the internet, literally every day, some of us almost every hour, actually a percentage of us technically every minute because we're not offline. And yet we don't well know the story of its origin, the way we know, other technologies, Ben Franklin, Thomas Edison. But most people don't know the story of the early internet creators. And they're fun stories, they're interesting, the story of, the very first social network and how it came out of, people, wanting to talk about appropriately enough science fiction to, where the first emoticon came from. And then you get the, second part of it, which is this idea of, how it connects back to the issues of today and the role of these companies. The creators of these spaces that we use for fun, to post our, vacation videos, that we use to date, that we use for commerce, but also that groups that range from ISIS to Russia to Chicago gangs use to, fight their wars, where did they come from? And the, reality is they came from, Facebook comes from a young Mark Zuckerberg writing a program that allows his fellow students to rate whether they are hot or not. And then he's now running in some ways, you can buy a number, it's the most populous nation in the world, if you think about the citizens of Facebook, so to speak. But more importantly, what he allows or not on that platform can determine the outcomes of elections. It can determine the outcomes of battles. It can determine the outcomes of whether a genocide is spurred on or not. It can determine the outcome of whether terrorist attacks are sparked or broadcast out to the world. And none of these are a made-up example. We talk about them in the book. So it's this, strange disconnect of where they come from and what that all means. So it's I think it's really fascinating, but it's important for all of us to know that history.
Speaking of history, you cite some examples of how different technology has disrupted military campaigns in the past, and you use it as a point of comparison, sometimes looking at tactical advancements, but often communications has been a key factor. How is social media similar to previous technological changes, and how is it different?
I think that's a really fascinating area. And that was, frankly, I'm a bit of a history buff. So this seems like we're talking about, high technology and the future, but I love the history side. And there's many remarkable parallels to how there were changes in the past and their impact. A good example would be the telegraph that allows suddenly people from long distances to link together, creates the first proto networks. And then of course you get, the fun side story. So, an example, when you think about the parallel of the internet and the telegraph, the important role of government, there was actually a debate in Congress on whether to fund the first telegraph line And the alternative was to do a study on essentially mind control, telepathy. So, you know, it was either to do, can we communicate, you know, via telepathy or via this strange idea of connecting wires and electricity. And fortunately, they funded the telegraph one instead. But, you know, very soon, the telegraph, as you note, changes the story of war. It's changes the tactics. You know, you think about during the American Civil War, I believe it's well over 15,000 miles of telegraph line are brought together, and it allows military units and operations to connect in different ways and move more rapidly, et cetera, changes their supply chain. It changes the way commanders control, but also connects it back to the politicians in fundamentally new ways. You know, everything from very early on in the telegraph, suddenly politicians and generals sitting in London are sending battle orders to Crimea during the Crimean War. That's in Russia, thousands of miles away. Very quickly, Abraham Lincoln is getting same hour, same minute battle reports. It connects the public in fundamentally new ways, where the public is hearing about the outcomes of battles, and it's providing feedback to those politicians in a more rapid manner. It very soon leads to the rise of what we now call fake news, war reporting. In fact, during the War of 1898, you have newspapers that change their byline to talk about how they aren't providing, they'll say, no fake news. One of the St. Louis newspapers has that. So you get this kind of massive change. Also, oh, by the way, you get the role of these early tycoons and maybe their play in sparking wars. You think about, you know, the stories of, you know, sending reporters to Cuba and saying, you know, I'll provide you the war. And so you see many of these same things playing out with social media, just now brought into instant form. But then importantly, it's unleashed in a manner that the telegraph isn't, because we can bring it with us anywhere. And each of us is now our own reporter, editor, publisher. So each of us has that power. And so, you know, you can see this in everything from it's broken up the role of the war correspondent. You know, you have in anywhere there's a battle, there is a civilian that's now taking photos, talking about it. That's changed, you know, not just war reporting, but the very nature of secrecy itself. One of the examples in the book is the bin Laden raid, supposed to be the most secretive military operation in, you know, recent history. And, you know, the Navy SEAL team isn't even told the final target until the helicopter takes off. And yet a Pakistani cafe owner in Abbottabad is up late at night. He hears helicopters coming in, and he does the new natural thing. He goes online to complain about it. So he's sharing the news and complaining, and his tweets act as live battle reports. So it's changed kind of the nature of reporting and secrecy. It's also changed the nature of politics, maybe not the nature, but it's certainly shook up politics. And, you know, the great example of this would be Donald Trump, who very proudly talks about how his Twitter feed is his own newspaper, edited by the, you know, in his description, the perfect editor, and that it has allowed him to sidestep other mechanisms, other measures, other media channels. And it also, his mastery of it allowed him to rise to power, defeat his rivals, first in the Republican nomination and then Hillary Clinton, in a way that previously wouldn't have been possible. So there's lots of this different shakeup that's out there. And again, it's going to be with us for the long term. So just like how the telegraph changed the kinds of politicians that arose. There's no Abraham Lincoln without the telegraph. The telegraph is the key to bringing him notoriety, from the Lincoln-Douglas debates to how television creates the need for telegenic politicians. Now, skill set in social media is changing that set again. And, you know, Trump is only the first of many to come.
And I guess when you talk about some failed propaganda attempts in the past, such as radio shows and leaflets that didn't really get a lot of traction, you point out that social media, it is different and it is a lot more effective. Why is that? And do you see social media as more of a tactical weapon in war than other communications channels?
It is a battle space where information can be weaponized. And because of its ability to be widely proliferated in everyone's hands, so to speak, and its global aspect of it, in that, you know, unlike, say, the telegraph or even a TV camera, you can be a fighter in these wars thousands of miles away. It provides a kind of new freedom, but also new power. And when I say a fighter in these wars, the role that might be played might be anything from a intelligence analyst, a new form of that. So, for instance, one of the things we talk about in the book is these people who investigate war crimes from afar. One of the gentlemen that we interviewed, you know, is a great story where he lives in North Carolina, and yet he scans social media to help document war crimes committed by Russia in places like Ukraine and Syria, finding little tidbits that are popping up and piecing them together. You can think of him as almost like a work from home Sherlock Holmes. And, you know, the great twist of it is that his in-laws think he's just kind of fooling around on the computer, and yet he's become this core player in, you know, important stories of not just human rights, but geopolitics today. You have that kind of analytic side. You might be a participant through some kind of crowdsourcing, and this can be both funding someone from afar to a darker version of that. So if you have the good side of, you know, war crimes reporters from afar, there's a bad side story of a Iraqi militia that posted to the world images of a POW and said, in effect, world, tell us what to do with them. People from around the world, including the United States, voted and determined the POW's fate. And then 2 hours later, the militia posted a selfie with the body in the background, dark version of this. Your participation might be through helping to drive that message viral. So just simply what you choose to watch or not, what you choose to thumbs up or not, will help determine whose side of the conflict is the one that wins out in the global narrative. And then that will actually have impact on the battlefield operations themselves. You can see this everywhere from ISIS in the Battle of Mosul to the back and forth between Israel and Palestine, where the world's views actually has real effect on everything from battlefield tactics. For example, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, are tracking what's winning out online or not, and then they're reshaping their air campaign around that, to in Battle of Mosul, ISIS's message is the one that trends, so to speak, and it's the one, therefore, that's filling the smartphones of Iraqi soldiers. And so when ISIS says it's winning, it actually looks like it's winning, and then it really does win. The Iraqi soldiers run away, and you have this strange story where an invasion force of around 2,500 routs a defending force of around 20,000 that's supported by the world's most powerful military. And yet, because of the online side, it's able to crack that. And so I could kind of go on and on about this globalization in a manner that makes it different than before. So, you know, so much of this you see threads in history, but we also see new twists and turns on it. And then there's a final part of this, again, you know, to go back to what we were talking about of Clausewitz, there's the melding of politics and warfare. So Russia's disinformation campaigns. It is the social media, the internet has allowed a reach into other nations' politics in a way that wasn't possible before. So to give like a comparison, at the start of World War I, one of the most important moments of it, and we talk about in the book, is when this trawler basically takes a hook and pulls up a couple of wires at the bottom of the ocean and snips them. And from that point on, Germany couldn't connect to the United States. It couldn't provide, these were telegraph lines. And so Great Britain owns, in effect, the narrative of the war. And the United States basically goes from thinking about staying out of the war to several years later joining the war. Today, you can't do that. You can't snip the wire that way. And so you can reach into other nations' politics and you can, in effect, sometimes even use information warfare techniques to exploit them. And that's really what we saw with the Russian campaign, where in many ways it's this kind of combination of information warfare, but also the export of censorship and into other nations, and it was incredibly effective. So you see Russian military units affecting the domestic politics and democratic discourse in other nations. And of course, everyone else looked at that and said, huh, that worked for them. We can do that too. So you and I are talking in late September 2018, and many of the very same dynamics that played out in the 2016 election we're continuing to see today. And it's things in our own politics. So for example, we've seen evidence of Russian disinformation activities, kind of this divide and conquer, spread distrust on the topics that range from the Charlottesville protests to the NFL anthem controversy. But we've also seen it pop up in other nations' elections, Macedonia to Mexico. The recent Mexican election, about one third of the online conversation about it was generated by artificial voices, trolls and bots, which sadly is almost the exact same percentage of what happened during Brexit. And meaning that, you know, it's still out there and we've not gotten better at dealing with it.
On that point, you say in the book that information literacy is now a national security imperative. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
This is a space where we are all customers. We are all citizens. We are all now targets and kind of combatants. If you are online, and most of us are, and definitely most of our kids are online, and we are using it again for everything from dating to buying to getting our news. So we're part of this. And unfortunately, we're not all that well equipped for it. And when I say we, it's everything from understanding just the basics of how this battle space / economy works. The majority of Americans don't know how social media companies make their money. We know how TV channels make their money. They sell commercials. Most of us know that, but most of us don't understand the system here. And, you know, maybe some of your listeners are saying, well, I do. Well, you may, but your uncle or aunt or your 14-year-old kid. And importantly, they have a real challenge in figuring out when something is an ad, when something is a real news report, when something is a authentic voice, when it's not an authentic voice. And again, that's important because you're being targeted both for commerce, but also as part of these conflicts, including, you know, to try and cause you to act in a very different way, whether to buy something, whether to vote differently, turn up at a protest or not, you name it. So we have this problem set, and we can kind of go on and on about it. My belief is, you know, frankly, we need to learn more and be better equipped at this. And what's really fascinating, again, is when you look at the studies on this, your intelligence level, being smart or not. Oh, but I'm smart. I don't have to worry about this. Sorry, the studies show that that's not a inoculator against being taken in by fake news or the like. There's, you know, essentially, you know, very basic techniques in discerning it that most of us don't do. And you know, you're, no matter how smart you are, it's still being taken in. Another way of thinking about this is, you know, you can kind of think of the parallel of a card game. If you sit down at the poker table and you don't know who the sucker is, you're the mark. And there's a little bit of that going on in the social media space. But the national security side of it is so crucial because, again, it's something that is targeting us in a realm that's going after our core democracy. And what's fascinating is that the United States, which, you know, most of the listeners of this podcast are from, we were the creator of the internet, but we are now the example that the rest of the world uses of what not to do. We're the victim that everyone wants to avoid becoming. You know, so for example, when Sweden's saying, how do we deal with this? They're openly saying, look at what happened to the United States. Let's do everything different. And so you can look at these models of what other nations have done to better protect themselves at a national level all the way down to the individual level. And again, it ranges from, you know, government work down to digital literacy campaigns. And much like in any other kind of literacy, you know, whether it's actual literacy, teaching how to read, to public health literacy, hygiene, it's a role that crosses from, you know, government does it, school does it, companies weigh in, but also parents and citizens weigh in. But to go back to it, you have all these models from other nations that we can implement. One of the strangest parts of this, though, is that in some cases, the U.S. government has actually funded some of these digital literacy campaigns for other nations. So, for example, we're paying millions of dollars to help Ukrainian students and citizens better discern Russian disinformation operations and figure out what is real or not news online, and we're not doing it for our kids enough. Isn't that strange?
Well, you mentioned in the book that you actually became the target of a troll. Can you tell us what happened with that?
Oh, I mean, we've had a lot of different examples of that. I mean, anyone online has become a target of a troll definitively. What we did in the book was set, try and troll the trolls, set, you know, honeypots and post things. Honeypot, you know, if you're a fan of, you know, espionage, James Bond books or movies, you know, honeypot is the sexy agent that, you know, draws them out. And there's, of course, real world versions of this, you know, so in James Bond, it was Vesper Lynd. In the real world, it was, in quotation marks, Anna Chapman. She was the first of many, actually, redheaded, now we know, Russian agents that came to the United States. Anna Chapman was the one who was caught by the FBI and then sent back to Russia, where, appropriately enough to the topic, she's now become she was celebrated by Vladimir Putin, and she's done Facebook lingerie modeling. What a world we're in. This idea of a honeypot, what we did online is post things that we knew would potentially draw out trolls and sort of lead them to reveal themselves. So, for example, we posted things related to the shoot down of the airliner over Ukraine. And then, you know, without any action on our part, suddenly being targeted by people who want to tell us the truth of what really happened. No, Russia had nothing to do with this, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can backtrack and see their activities. And, you know, that's one aspect of this. Then, of course, you have the other part that filters back into our political discourse, the growing operation activity, however you want to frame it. Basically, the growth of some of the, I would describe them as the worst people online and in the real world, neo-Nazis, white nationalists, white supremacists, the broader group of the alt-right, who, you know, play a kind of both very real and serious and, I would argue, dangerous to our democracy and our core values. But there's also this kind of game that they're playing within this space. And so we engaged in a little bit of that as well, baiting them to come out and see how they operate and learning from that.
It sounds like researching this book was really interesting. Are there any memorable interviews you could share with us?
Oh, gosh. I mean, this book was both incredibly fun and sometimes incredibly depressing, you know, when you think about the activities of these worse people online. And frankly, that, and this is part of the problem, many of them have been incentivized to do more, rewarded to do more. One of the episodes we talk about in the book is Pizzagate and how some of the core people behind Pizzagate have, you know, where Pizzagate, where, you know, this weird online conspiracy theory takes off. A guy believes it, shows up at a Washington, D.C. Pizza parlor with a gun, you know, scares the families and kids and the people behind it who helped spur this on. Many of them have, you know, gone on to, you know, everything from getting book deals to getting jobs as professional journalists to the ultimate reward of all in this space, being invited to the White House where they flashed white nationalist symbology and then being retweeted by the president itself. So you kind of have this kind of depressing side of things. And then you have the fun moments. Some of the most fun characters, a couple jump to mind. One is the story of Farah Pandith, who is a Muslim American woman who had lost family members to terrorism and then has dedicated her life to countering terrorism. And first she works in the U.S. government, but then the more and more that she engages, particularly with Muslim youth around the world, she realizes, I can't do this effectively enough within the U.S. government. And so she's left, and now she's organizing. She's basically taking the same lessons of how groups like ISIS thrived and using it back against them. And she's building what she jokingly calls her Dumbledore's army. If you know your Harry Potter, it's basically the teenagers who gather on their own to do the fight against evil. So she's building this online coalition of effectively teens to go after the terrorist recruiters and particularly the people that they're targeting. Because, you know, if you're a teenager and you're being targeted, well, the U.S. government can say, blah, 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 blah. It's not going to be all that valuable versus another teenager weighing in and saying, hey, these guys are definitely not cool. They're, you know, so that's a great, we found her a really powerful story. One of the more amusing stories was, this is going to really reveal how much of your listeners, you know, how deeply they are in pop culture or not. Spencer Pratt. Spencer Pratt was one of the first reality stars. He was a on a TV show called The Hills. He also produced he was both on a show. He also produced another show, which is notable because it was the show that brought the Kardashians into this world of celebrity and the like. And Spencer basically talked us through how you manipulate the media to get what you want. And how he's one of these people that is, in effect, he became quite famous, but kind of really, and as his critics would say, well, but for nothing, what did he do and the like? But he basically figured out how to work the system. And he'd figured out these kind of rules of the game. And so Spencer and his wife, Heidi, and they became famous, Spidey, they talk us through how you manipulate the media and the like. And you know, they're doing it. They live in California, and their cute little dog is yapping in the background. And it's sort of silly. But then what's funny to me about it is, you know, first, they have these really kind of interesting, you know, they're mixing kind of stories of celebrity with these incredible insights. But then what was fascinating is very soon after, we're doing this interview with these, you know, celebrities who figured out kind of how to work the system. We interviewed the U.S. government's, the person in charge of counter ISIS propaganda. And we're going to the State Department and we're interviewing them. And in the midst of this, I had this kind of realization. They don't get it. And the celebrity does. And if only the celebrity was helping to guide some of this, we would be in a better place. And it was just sort of strange. So it was both an incredibly fun interview, but also you get these kind of strange insights. And oh, by the way, you know, that sounds strange and weird to say, but there are people who are, you know, a different example, you know, professional political campaigners. And they feel the exact same thing right now about Donald Trump being president, that initially they looked at it and they said, you know, by all the rules of how political campaigns are supposed to work, there is no way he should win. And yet he did, because the rules have changed. And so we've, you know, again, need to kind of understand what's going on, whether it's us as the operators in this field, us the people who study it, to us the people who are the target of all of this.
PW, we've taken up a lot of your time. Before we let you go, can you tell us how the book launch is going?
It's been so much fun. So you and I are talking a couple weeks before the book actually comes out. It comes out on October 2nd, you know, hopefully available in stores near people, definitely on all the different online sites where you buy books. But what's been incredibly fun and fascinating is that I've had lots of opportunities to talk about the book and its findings and lessons before it's even been out there. So, you know, I've already briefed some of the lessons of it at places that range from the CIA to the National Security Council to actually just yesterday, a conference where the head of the U.S. Navy each year hosts a conference for the heads of all the other world's navies. So it's like 100 admirals in a room. And, you know, I'm able to talk about some of the lessons of the book. And that's just been obviously really rewarding and fascinating. And I'm excited to see, you know, what's going to happen once the book actually comes out.
Great. Well, thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Like Wars by P.W. Singer and Emerson Brooking is available October 2nd from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and is available for pre-order now. You can follow New Books Network on Twitter at New Books Network and the New Books Network National Security Channel at New Books NatSec.